Today, on this very auspicious day, Sri Aurobindo's birthday, we are gathered around as children of the mother, gathered around Kirit Bhai. A few days back, Dr. Kirit Joshi spoke to me about a project dear to his heart. And he also told me about what the mother had said to him regarding taking care of her children, giving them what they needed, which he alone could give. And he hastened to add that mother's children are not merely little children, but also all of us, including him. And so I proposed to him that we could have this format for exploration of the project which he proposed. And Kiriji's project, I have mentioned, it is a new synthesis of yoga as a necessity to overcome the impasse of modernity. Now this topic Kirit Bhai will explore with us.
Let me begin by saying that I feel quite privileged this evening to be with everyone. And as Debashish has explained, this subject which is dear to me is to explore with everyone, first of all, the impasse through which modernity is passing, and to realize this impasse, and to see how this impasse can be crossed, can be surmounted, or can be resolved. At a given time, this impasse was seen to be such an impasse that it could not be crossed at all. It is for that reason that I regard Sri Aurobindo and the mother as the greatest helpers who have taken up the burden of this impasse. And what is extremely significant is that they have crossed the impasse. They have made a way, hewn a path, so that it may be easier for the whole humanity, depending upon certain conditions, also to cross this impasse. I think that it is in that context that the synthesis of yoga, which Sri Aurobindo and the mother have developed, is so important. And it is for that reason that we first of all need to study this synthesis of yoga and to understand this yoga to the best of our ability, and then to see how we can ourselves participate in the process of this yoga. This can be a long process, and I am prepared to be with all of you for as long as you think we can continue together today and later on, periodically, and I shall be happy to be on this subject, and we shall develop this subject leisurely, in the sense that we need not cross over this subject rapidly like a capsule. We can explore this subject because it is extremely important, and to my mind, the most important subject of today. It is so important that if I am asked, what would you like to do for students of the world today, I would simply say that if I can discuss with them this question, and if I can explore this question with them, I'll be fulfilled. This is what I would regard to be perhaps the task to be carried out for young people today. Let me therefore begin this subject by saying that we need to look upon ourselves as pilgrims. We are on a journey, and we are all together, and let us assume that each one of us wants to do the best, to reach the highest, and wishes to be fulfilled up to the highest possible limits, or even limitlessly. And if we are traveling together, we shall ask, what exactly is a starting point? Where are we? Because each one of us has journeys enough. The history of the world also has journeys for millions of years, and we have arrived at a certain point. Even human history has been quite long, and it may be quite useful for us to summarize, first of all, it is a human history. Now, there are many ways by which you can summarize human history, and I should like to share it with you in the Divine, which is the magnum opus of Sri Aurobindo. There are several places where he has summarized the whole history of the world in different contexts. And for different purposes. I have before me one passage, one paragraph, where he has summarized in one paragraph the entire human history. It is in the second volume of The Life Divine. The chapter is entitled The Divine Life. And for those who might have access to The Life Divine, I shall give them the reference exactly of that page on which one can read at leisure and reflect on it. Because among several paragraphs of this kind, I think this is such a succinct and precise summary of the world history that it brings us rapidly from the ancient times to the present day and shows exactly where we are now facing an impasse. In this paragraph, Sri Aurobindo proposes that ultimately the human race can find justification of its existence if it can arrive at individual perfection and collective perfection. And in order to arrive at that perfection, Sri Aurobindo makes one basic premise which is extremely significant. He points out that human nature is complex. And this word is very important. Human nature is complex. It has got many elements and many parts. And these parts are not absolutely in harmony with each other. First of all, he has got a physical aspect, and then vital mental aspects, and then a spiritual aspect. And then Sri Aurobindo points out that since we are all on the physical earth, and in a sense we are all children of the earth, it is quite natural that human nature aims first of all at establishing a physical base of existence as securely as possible. And once that is done, there is a farther search. And Sri Aurobindo points out that the development of the mind would be the second occupation of man. And in the history of the world, he refers to the Hellenistic period, where the human mind came to be developed to a great extent. And the early Greek civilization stands out as an example of a state of humanity, at least in that part of the world, where some kind of mental faculties were developed and some kind of harmonization was aimed at, as a result of which Greek civilization and thereafter later on Roman civilization, as it is known, Greco-Roman civilization, developed. And Sri Aurobindo said, in a sense, when Roman civilization tried to capture Greek civilization itself was weakened to some extent because, again, there was a tremendous pressure in Roman civilization towards rule of law and organization, and they collided with the free movement of the mental consciousness development. Thereafter, there was a need for a higher development because spirituality is a higher element, and that was the element that should normally pressurize human beings to develop in that direction. In ancient civilizations, Sri Aurobindo says, particularly in the East, the message of spiritual development became extremely important and prominent. And the fruits of spiritual development of the ancient times were passed on from Buddhism to Asia and to Egypt. And from there, Christianity took birth. And this spiritual heritage was, as it were called, in West. And that is how we find in Europe the growth of spiritual civilization. But all that was effected in a very difficult period when invasions of barbarism, one after the other, had come over Europe. And the light of Christianity was, as it were, like a torchlight, not a searchlight. And before it could be assimilated or before it could make a big impact, there was a reversal. There was some kind of a new development and reaffirmation of the cult of reason. And at this point of time, the greatest light light that was developed was the light of science. It is with this light of science that today we have a rationalistic culture, scientific culture, and it has tended to serve the economic organization. And the attempt of the whole mankind today is centered on economic development and arrival at some kind of organization whereby physical life, with the light of science and other facilities to be created by science, the political, social, economic life could be securely established. As a result of this, there is today a reversal in which economic organization and the economic aim of life seems to preponderate. And this is exactly the point at which we are. If you allow me, I would like to read out those few lines from Sri Aurobindo just to make ourselves quite precise about what Sri Aurobindo said about world history right from early times to the present day. I shall refer to this particular page in Life Divine. Those who have got centenary edition, it is on page number 1051. But those who don't have the book, doesn't matter, because there is recently a new edition of Life Divine. This is, the Divine Life is the last chapter of the Life Divine. The page number 1051 in the centenary edition. And I'll read out to you that passage. Sri Aurobindo says, our nature is complex and we have to find a key to some perfect unity and fullness of its complexity. Its first evolutionary basis is the material life. Nature began with death and man also has to begin with it. He has first to affirm his material and vital existence. But if he stops there, there can be for him no evolution. His next and greater preoccupation must be to find himself as a mental being in a material life, both individual and social, as perfected as possible. This was the direction which the Hellenic idea gave to European civilization, and the Roman reinforced or weakened it with the ideal of organized power, the cult of reason, the interpretation of life by an intellectual thought, critical, utilitarian, organizing, and constructive. The government of life by science are the last outcome of this iteration. In ancient times, the higher creative and dynamic element was the pursuit of an ideal beauty and the molding of mind, life, and body into perfection and harmony by the ideal. Beyond and above this preoccupation, as soon as mind is sufficiently developed, there awakes in man a spiritual preoccupation, the discovery of the self and impersonal of me, and the release of man's mind and life into the truth of the spirits, perfection by the power of the spirits, the solidarity, unity, mutuality of all beings in the spirits. This was the Eastern ideal carried by Buddhism and other ancient disciplines to the coasts of Asia and Egypt, and from there poured by Christianity into Europe. But these motives, burning for a time like dim torchlights in the confusion and darkness created by the barbaric flood that had submerged the old civilizations, have been abandoned by the modern spirit, which has found another light, the light of science. What the modern spirit has sought for is the economic, social ultimate, an ideal material organization of civilization and comfort, the use of reason and science and education for the generalization of the utilitarian rationality, which will make the individual a perfected social being in a perfected economic society. What remained from the spiritual ideal was, for a time, a mentalized and moralized humanitarianism, relieved of all religious coloring, and a social ethicism, which was deemed all-sufficient to take the place of a religious and individual ethic. It was so far that the rays had reached and found itself flooding forward by its own momentum into a subjective chaos, and a chaos of its life in which all received values were overthrown and all firm ground seemed to disappear from its social organization, its conduct, and its culture. This is, according to me, one of the best quotations in the Life Divine, where Sri Aurobindo has summarized the history of the world from the beginning to the present day. The briefest and the most precise summary of the history of humankind. It is at this point that a very serious problem has arisen. And this is the point which I want to mark particularly. Having reached here, we have to ask ourselves, what next? It is true that we have not yet finished our journey in our search of a perfected economic, utilitarian life, an economic being perfected in a social society. Even that aim has not yet been realized. And today, the march of science is being utilized largely by humanity for this purpose. Now, according to Sri Aurobindo, and this is a very important reading, if mankind becomes engaged, engrossed exclusively on the perfection of economic life, there is a big danger. Sri Aurobindo points out that perfection of economic life certainly as an element of the total perfection of mankind is necessary. But if that aim becomes all-exclusive aim, then it will be a kind of reversion to what Sri Aurobindo calls barbarism. We must remember that Sri Aurobindo has traced the history of mankind in another direction, in another context, particularly in the human cycle, where Sri Aurobindo speaks of three stages of mankind, the infrarational, the rational, and the suprarational, where he has pointed out that for a long time, humanity developed from infrarational into rational, and that rational age is now coming to a close. But exactly at this point where rational age is coming to a close and something higher should happen, the infrarational is making its way upward on the surface and wants to dominate the present state of soul life. This economic aim of life, which has now become so dominant in mankind today, is what Sri Aurobindo calls reversal to barbarism. Now, Sri Aurobindo points out that barbarism, if you want to define properly, is a state of existence in which human beings become attached to the physical life and utilize whatever higher developments men may have for the development of the physical life, economic life. This barbarism is a force of invasion. Now, Sri Aurobindo also points out that in the history of mankind, whenever there was a development at a higher level, it was sought to be arrested and attacked by some fresh invasion of barbarism. That is why we see in the history of mankind various attacks coming one after the other. Barbarism has been always a force of invasion coming from outside upon a civilized world. Today, the situation is somewhat different. Today, civilized society is sufficiently widespread, and in that vast expanse of civilization, barbarism is rising within itself. It is no more invasion of barbarism from outside. It is as it were from the very bosom of civilization, barbarism is rising. And if this barbaric invasion is not answered, not arrested, not replied, not combated properly and rightly, a big danger can be expected. And this is the point which is creating what may be called an impasse. How to allow the human society to rise upward, and how to develop the intellectuality which has been developed very widely, particularly present through the force of science, and how to lead mankind to the next step beyond the rationalistic. That today there is a tremendous pressure to move forward beyond the rationality can be seen in many ways. In due course of time, we shall study this aspect also. But the very fact that today reason itself has come to some kind of a circular movement, implying no further possibility of movement, is an indication that we have come to an end of the curve of the age of reason. It's a very vast subject, but the fact is that there is on one hand a tremendous pressure for mankind to develop spiritual consciousness. And this pressure is thwarted by the barbarism which is rising. According to Sri Aurobindo, reason can play a very dominant and important role to help mankind to cross over this impasse. But Sri Aurobindo points out that reason is not able to keep pace with the race which is going on. And that is why there is a great possibility that reason may not be able to play the right role it is supposed to play. According to Sri Aurobindo, the role of reason is a visionary role, intermediate role, a role between the physical, economic, vital life and the spiritual life. The intellect is an intermediate power, and it can help the economic life, the physical life, vital life of man, and can open the doors and can aid mankind to enter into the spiritual age. The big question mark is whether reason will be able to give this aid. And Sri Aurobindo points out that this aid is very difficult to come because the race is very rapid and reason is not able to run with that race. So let us say, this is the impasse. The pressure of the economic man combating the upward movement of man towards spirituality, where his reason can help him, their reason is not able to help. On the contrary, it can even produce a kind of a big barrier. What will happen? Sri Aurobindo has envisaged a great possibility of what he terms the failure of the human race. The human race, which was supposed to lead the whole evolutionary process toward the higher level of existence, where the basic aim of human life can be fulfilled, namely perfection of the individual and perfection of the collective life, and the two harmonized together, that was envisaged, and that human beings envisage even today as the perfection of life. This aim may not be realized at all through the agency of human race. And therefore, one possibility that Sri Aurobindo envisaged was that human race may fail and human species may be itself put aside as one species, as a failed species. And that evolutionary process may create another species for the development of the ideal condition of existence. If we examine this possibility, Sri Aurobindo, you might say, has been able to accomplish a tremendous task. One can say that that impasse, that is to say, is a result of which human race would have been regarded as a failure. That possibility has been crossed over. And that I consider to be the great accomplishment of Sri Aurobindo and the mother through the synthesis of yoga which Aurobindo's mother have proposed to us. But before I go forward, read out to you the next passage from the same particular part of Life Divine. This is the next passage where Sri Aurobindo summarizes this great problem of the impasse. Sri Aurobindo says, this conscious stress on the material and economic life was in fact a civilized reversion to the first state of man, his early barbaric state. And its preoccupation with life and matter, a spiritual regression with the resources of the mind of a developed humanity and a fully evolved science at its disposal. As an element in the total complexity of human life, this stress on a perfected economic and material existence has its place in the whole, as a sole or predominant stress, it is for humanity itself, for the evolution itself, full of danger. The first danger is a resurgence of the old vital and material primitive barbarian in a civilized form. The means science has put at our disposal eliminates the peril of the subversion and destruction of an effete civilization by stronger primitive peoples. But it is a resurgence of the barbaric in ourselves, in civilized man, that is the peril. And this we see all around us. For that is bound to come. If there is no high and strenuous mental and moral ideal controlling and uplifting the vital and physical man in us, and no spiritual ideal liberating him from himself into his inner being. Even if this relapses escape, there is another danger for a cessation of the evolutionary urge. A crystallization into a stable, comfortable, mechanized social living without ideal or outlook is another possible outcome. Reason by itself cannot long maintain the race in its progress. It can do so only if it is a mediator between the life and body and something higher and greater within him. For it is the inner spiritual necessity, the push from what is there yet unrealized within him, that maintains in him oneself attained to mind the evolutionary stress, the spiritual nisus. That renounced, he must either relapse and begin all over again, or disappear like other forms of life before him, as an evolutionary failure through incapacity to maintain or to serve the evolutionary urge. At the best, he will remain arrested in some kind of mediocre typal perfection like other animal kinds, while nature pursues her way beyond him to a greater creation. I think this is one of the best passages in the Life Divine, where Sri Aurobindo presents to us in graphic terms, vivid terms, the great danger that mankind faces today. And I would like to add the following, that although, as I said, Sri Aurobindo and the mother, by developing the integral yoga, a new synthesis of yoga, they have crossed this barrier, and mankind is now in a happy condition of a possibility of receiving the light under which it can hope to realize the collective perfection and perfection of the individual, both harmonized together. Even then, it cannot be said that we have achieved such a state of development that the process will be very smooth and will be very safe. The dangers, perils still exist. In fact, I would like to refer to an anecdote. As you may be knowing, the Dalai Lama paid a visit to the mother on the 18th of January 1973. I had the privilege of receiving the Dalai Lama at Madras Airport to bring him to Pondicherry by car, and I accompanied him when he met the mother. So I was an eyewitness of the conversation that took place between the mother and the Dalai Lama. And he put several questions, including the question regarding Tibet. Because when the Dalai Lama arrived in the presence of the mother welcomed him by saying, both Sri Aurobindo and the mother want you to go back to Tibet with full power and authority. This is a tremendous statement, and naturally, therefore, later on, when I had been with Dalai Lama alone, he asked me to ask the mother whether and when Tibet will be free and whether he will be able to return to Tibet. And many other questions, mother, he had put. And next time when I went to the mother after 2 days, I had put those questions and mother had answered those questions. This was in 1973, one of the peak periods of mother's development of the integral yoga. And those who are interested in reading the questions that I had put to the mother and the answers that mother gave, they may refer to the 13th volume of Mother's Agenda. And there is a dialogue where this is on page number 352, volume number 13 of the Mother's Agenda. And I want to read out a few lines from this conversation because it concerns the exact question that I would like to dwell upon. My question was concerning the supramental manifestation. As we all know, the mother declared on 29th of February 1956, the supermind manifested on the earth. And this is a golden day for all of us. And by 1973, the supermind and its movement had reached a tremendous stage of peak development. And when we read Mother's Agenda 13 volumes, we find how the supermind was acting on the earth. In fact, Mother herself has given a subtitle to the agenda. And this is very, very important. Mother has called it the agenda of the supramental action upon earth. She herself has given this title to the agenda. So you might say that all the 13 volumes of the Mother's Agenda describe stages after stages of the development of the supramental manifestation. And on the day on which I had this talk with the mother, this was the 20th of January, 1973. And I was so enthusiastic about the question that the Dalai Lama had put to the mother, and particularly this question about the freedom of Tibet. And mother answered this question by saying the following: if the teaching of Sri Aurobindo can spread over the world, and if there is a full manifestation of the supramental, then the supramental will be the power of liberation of Tibet. Then mother added, it is bound to come. It will come. But if it goes as it is going now, it will take hundreds of years. But if the supramental is manifested, it may come quick. Quick does not mean 10 or 20 years. That would be almost miraculous. Now when mother said this, I spoke to the mother and said, but the supramental is now working very powerfully. This question, the mother answered, and I would like to emphasize this answer because it is extremely important for all of us to share this answer, because that is where we are now. Mother said, it is working. It will be manifested with enough power when the right people have the authority. For the moment, it seems that the opposition, the falsehood, attacks with full power before dying. Never have men lied as much as they are doing now. It seems the old habit comes spontaneously, but it must be broken. We are at a very, what we could call, an unpleasant moment of the history of the earth. It is interesting because the action is very powerful, but I can't call it pleasant. And then mother added one line. But I have told you that already. I wrote it. Now mother was referred to a message that she had given me in the month of November of 1972. And let me read out that message which mother had given. This was the message of November 26, 1972. The message is as follows. Before dying, falsehood rises in full swing. Still, people understand only the lesson of catastrophe, which have to come before they open their eyes to the truth. I ask an effort from all so that it is not to be. It is only the truth that can save us. Truth in words, truth in action, truth in will, truth in feeling. It is a choice between serving the truth or being destroyed. So, this was after the supermind had already descended, it was working powerfully, and even at that stage, this problem persisted. His mother said, falsehood is rising in full swing. And I do not think personally that that period has fully been traversed, even till today. Although, if you ask me personally, I would say that the compass is so great that the balance is on the other way around. That is to say, in favor of the truth against the falsehoods. Although at that time, falsehood was always triumphant and truth was at the receiving end. So this is my personal view, but I personally feel that even then, message is difficult, and we have to be very responsible at this stage, and that is why I would like to explore this subject with all of you. But for the moment, I'll stop here and invite a few questions, if any questions have arisen in the minds of our friends.
Particularly, I'm thinking about the issue of the impasse. This impasse, as you said, which we are going through at present, and this special kind of barbarism, and in that second quotation you read from The Life Divine, it seemed to me that Sri Aurobindo is pointing to two possibilities of barbarism. One which seems more like hedonistic barbarism, and the other more sinuous, because he called it a comfortable condition without any idealism.
Yes.
Now, this comfortable condition without any idealism, where the aspiration disappears because man is happy with his material state, sort of like the ideal of Russian socialism, which in a different way is coming to us today in our modern world. It seems as if there is a certain kind of satisfaction with life and what it can give. Do you think that this can last as a condition in which humanity becomes typified, as he says, with a type of perfection? Or is it inevitable that the aspiration from within will force us out of it?
Well, I think I will repeat your question to some extent. Please tell me if I understood your question properly. Your question is that Sri Aurobindo refers to two alternative possibilities. One is reversal of mankind, in which mankind would revert to a comfortable hedonistic life.
Yes.
And if that happens, maybe that there will be a sinking of mankind and a kind of a failure of mankind on account of the reversal of mankind to that condition. The other possibility is that even if mankind does not sink, even if mankind is not destroyed as a race, another possibility would be to create a civilization or a barbaric civilization in which human beings would find a tolerable, comfortable, mechanical, facilitated existence. Somewhere where people get clothing, shelter, and basic necessities of life quite easily and in sufficient measure. And therefore, people would remain like animals chewing their guts, as it were, and watching the world and engage in cinema and drama and all kinds of pleasures of life and doing some work here, some work there, and flying from one place to the other and spending time. And in which case, it would be a kind of typical economic life established on the earth. And I think this is your second hypothesis. And I think that's your question, is it? Now,
yes,
I think that both the alternatives.
Particularly that second hypothesis. Yes. I see that second hypothesis as something which is very close to realization in a very large section of humanity today. Giving them a certain kind of, a satisfied life in which there is no aspiration, no idealism.
Well, I think what you are saying, let me repeat also once again. You feel that the second possibility of arrival of a typical human life, economically satisfied and flourishing in comfort without the urge, evolutionary urge to go beyond. You feel that we are now almost nearing that kind of existence. Your question is whether I share that feeling. Is that so? Hello?
Yes, you are.
Yes. This is your question. Yes? Now, my answer is the following.
Yes.
My answer is the following. I only like to share with you my own feeling. That.
Of course, yes.
this possibility, I agree with you, is looming large. If, for example, there had to be a constant conflict between communism and capitalism, which was very much on the top of the agenda of the world at one time, if that conflict had remained, there was a tremendous impetus for an evolutionary earth to move forward. But we see that that situation is no more there, and there is a further development. Some people now speak of super capitalism coming over the earth and spreading over the whole earth, in which the conflict between communism and socialism on one side and capitalism on the other would not be there. So there is no combat, and there is therefore no quarrel on that basis. It is a kind of a comfortable condition for a capitalistic order of society in which something of socialism is assimilated, namely the ideal that everyone should get basic necessities of life. I think we are arriving at a point where socialism loses its edge because capitalism is able to provide to a large or increasing number of people the basic necessities of life, even within the capitalistic frame of society. And if this is multiplied, let us say within 20, 30, 40 years, there is this possibility. And it might actually lead to the cessation of the evolutionary urge in mankind. Fortunately, I think because Mother and Aurobindo race already high, and they have brought into the world new forces, I believe that it will no more be actualized. Although I would agree that we are almost arriving at that point, but I think something is going to happen. And it is death which we have to consider also during the course of our journey. What is that that will allow a new development which will not allow mankind to rest comfortably only in a typal existence of economic, social comfortable? Would you like to say something on this subject?
Thank you, Kiribai. No, I completely agree with you. I was just listening, so that
yes.
Answers your question. One thing of says that though this is the case, there is other kinds of conflicts that have also arisen, particularly those of an infra-rational kind with fundamentalism and terrorism and things of that nature. It is as if rationality is being attacked in its comfort zone by infra-rational forces as well at this point, and they have cried out for the key kinds of solutions. But this is restricted to certain areas of the world, and there are large areas where people are still sort of very comfortable in their, existence of material sufficiency. But I 100% agree with you and look forward to what you have over time regarding the other forces that Mother and Sri Aurobindo have brought. Would anybody else like to ask any questions at this point?
Yes.
Question is, is there anything that we could do as a physical action in all different countries, whoever or wherever, to fight against this apparent comfort and apparent unity in comfort? The reason is coming from the mind, which can play in either way. It is I mean, like Mother said, that mind can prove anything. So, I mean, we can convince ourselves about anything. So, and find some kind of unity in this comfortable community, which is largely found in corporate world in the United States, for example. So, what, of course, there are forces that are working because Mother and Sri Aurobindo have done their yoga. But as individuals, what is the, I mean, you know, very, with this course, can be suggested to be done to contribute anything against this force?
Well, I like your question very much, I must say. And although your question is, in a sense, limited, and which can be summarized by saying, what is it that we can do at this stage of development? And this question triggers off a number of things that to one's own mind. The most important thing to my mind is to develop in the world spiritual education. You know, there is a line of thinking according to which we are called upon to do many things, not only one thing. So if I say we should concentrate on spiritual education, it may seem as if I am proposing only one thing to be done. But if you examine this answer more properly, you'll find that this answer, spiritual education, implies a number of things to be done socially, politically, economically, cultural. And therefore, for the time being, I would only say in a general formula, let us concentrate upon the task of spiritual education in the world. If we can succeed in doing it, we shall have crossed a number of problems and resolved them. So, in due course of time, I would like to discuss with all of us this theme of spiritual education. Because the moment you speak of spiritual education, a number of objections are bound to arise. And to answer those questions, many questions concerning political life will have to be answered. Many questions of social life will have to be answered. So, for the moment, I just leave it with you only one line. The one thing that we can all participate in is the development of spiritual education.
I mean, is it possible for you to illustrate it more, like to be specific about, like by an example?
Let me say only one line. Spiritual education implies the creation of learning society. I don't know if you are aware of, or you must have read perhaps, this great report of UNESCO of 1971. You know, there are two great reports of UNESCO. One is a report which was given under the direction of Edgar Faure under the title Learning to Be. And another was in 1995, which is entitled Learning Treasure Within. These are the two great reports of UNESCO. I like both of them, but I like the first one better because it speaks of creating in the world learning society. And to my mind, that phrase, learning society, summarizes the problem of the world. world today. Learning society is one in which the center of the society is the child. It is not only child-centered education. It is not child-centered plus. It's a child-centered society. If you want spiritual education to be realized, it is not enough merely to make child the center of a class. It is necessary to make the child center of the whole society. That is to say, the child should be the sovereign of the society. And that brings a complete shift from the present mode of our social existence. Today, in the economic life, we speak of the sovereignty of the consumer. Not the child, the consumer is a sovereign. And everything in the world is the service of the consumer. Some other people speak today of the necessity of sustaining society by political organization. And large number of people have come to realize that democratic form of government is perhaps the most suitable form of the government if you want to meet the ends of liberty and so on. And therefore, they speak of creating a society which is democratic. And if you ask the question, what is a sovereign in a democratic country? The answer is sovereignty of the parliament. So if you want to sum up in a way, the entire social economic existence of modern world, and even the future perspective, if you look at the world, you might say that we are going to increase more and more the sovereignty of the consumer and the sovereignty of the parliament. But if you want to do spiritual education, then we have to establish in the world sovereignty of the child. Now you can see that this one example which I am giving you will show you the enormous implication of the sovereignty of the child and spiritual education for shifting the whole center of social existence, political existence, economic existence. You think it's a good example?
Yes, very much. Thank you. One thing I was still curious that, you know, sometimes it is said that, you know, a divine has to see you. You cannot see that point before that. So since the spiritual education is based on experience, so are you hopeful that with the child education, I mean, spiritual education amongst the children will really make a big difference, which is enough to fight this huge capitalist world?
It's a very, very good question. Your question is whether spiritual education will provide to the children sufficient power and capacity to fight against the present mode of life, economic, social, political life. My answer is that the very doing of spiritual education, the very process by which we shall be able to bring about the operation of spiritual education in the society will combat many, many problems which are today besieging the mankind. So I believe that if you see the implications of spiritual education and the process by which you can bring it about, I think at least for you and for me, this is a big task awaiting us. And if you start doing it, many tasks will unfold themselves.
I'd like to know how to contribute in that. My personal feeling has always been what the mother said, that the best way to help others is to grow in the spirit within. So I feel like that's the direction I'd like to go in, and also to pursue that goal through taking courses in learning more about Sri Aurobindo and the mother. I don't know, how does that fit into your collective worldview? Should I be doing more actively in pursuing things, or should I be more concentrating on growing within?
Your question is a very, very interesting question. Your statement is that, and this is in the context of what Mother has said, the best way of helping others is to make oneself more and more spiritual, and therefore to go within, and therefore to level up. And this is, of course, incontrovertible as far as I'm concerned. And I fully agree with your statement. The only question is that when you begin to grow within, how do you go about this? You know, there's a very interesting statement which the mother has made, and this is in connection with Aurobindo. He said, the path of our work lies with the task of research. And research in the new synthesis of yoga. In fact, that is the main theme of all my journey today. So my answer will be, the two are not contradictory. The going within and working on life, this is our method. And many people may find it difficult, but this is the method. And we have to find a solution as to how to go within and yet to work through life. Of course, it doesn't mean that there is no place in this yoga for solitude, for periods of complete seclusion even, but there are periods only. You can have an hour or two of seclusion if you like. Or some people may not even need that. It all depends upon each individual's needs. There are moments where you have to occupy yourself 24 hours out of 24 hours on some work. Or as sometime mother said, I never go into meditation at all. And this statement is also very cool. And yet, it is precisely because she's always in meditation. All work is being done through meditation. So, to conclude, I would simply say that your answer is, to me at least, is wonderful. What you have said is wonderful, that you would like to work on yourself and to develop spirit. And I would only add that it does not therefore mean that your task should not be related to activities. And I would very much like that all of us, whatever other occupations we will be engaged in, we should all undertake the task of spiritual education. We all are responsible in this world for the children of the world. And each one has to participate in the task of spiritual education. Is it all right?
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you. Devashish, is there any other question?
I was wondering about that very interesting conversation that you shared with us, with the mother, regarding the supramental manifestation, apropos the Dalai Lama's visit with her. And if I may recollect what you said there, has to do with the very powerful action of the supramental, but you said that it can
affects itself more speedily if there are the right people in power. Is that what you said? Would you like to comment on that? How is that possible? Yes.
Well, I would. It's a very, very important question, in fact. You know, I personally feel that one of the consequences of the supramental action, which I have myself experienced in my own personal life, is that at the right moment, the right people come to the right place of authority, through the exercise of which the right things can be done as speedily as possible. And I think that's a very important strategy of action. Supermind, according to me, is a power by which each person is placed in a position of highest effectiveness. Because the present world is topsy-turvy, those who ought to be in authority, they are in a very deplorable condition. Nobody listens to them. And though they are not worthy of being in the position of authority, they are occupying very high positions of authority. When the supermind begins to manifest more and more, this situation is bound to be reversed. And everyone who participates in this movement of supramental manifestation will find gradually occupying a position where effectivity of his or her faculties becomes truly fruitful. Authority does not mean necessarily coming to some high position. I personally believe authority means you are able to authorize the right action wherever you are, according to your capacity, according to your function, according to whatever you want to do. At present, it is being denied. In a certain sense, you might say that if a very good teacher is taken up from his teachership and is made a prime minister, where he cannot really function properly, his authority has been taken away. And this also is happening today. Those who should be very good teachers are holding very high positions of authority in politics. I am reminded of Sri Aurobindo's aphorism, where he says, "For thee, it is better to be a good shoemaker than to become an incompetent king." Now, that's a wonderful statement of Sri Aurobindo. And I think by authority, I mean, this is how I understand what Mother says, authority. To be effective at the right place in the right moment and occupy that position where you can exercise your faculties with the highest possible effectiveness. And I think this is what has to happen.
Can I ask you a question? This is Sitaram here.
Yes, certainly. Please, what is your name?
How to identify spiritual education, because in the past, a lot of other forms, like so many missionaries and others, in the name of spiritual education, basically did a lot more damage than anything else. So how to identify correct spiritual education?
I think your question is so important that I may not like to answer in one line. But since our time now is very little, your question, how to identify spiritual education, is distinguished from the kind of education that missionaries have been giving in different parts of the world. And I think, as you know, Mother has made a distinction between spiritual education and religion. And if you ask me what is the difference between what is being very often forced with education, but which is only religion, and how do you distinguish from what I call spiritual education? I will give only three examples. You see, according to me, spiritual education has three stages. The first is the study of concentration. This is something what Swami Vivekananda said while speaking of man-making education. And he said, if he knew in his early days the power of concentration, he would have spent time in learning the art and science of concentration than in reading so many books. Because not many people realize that concentration is a method of gaining knowledge. That is to say, if you want to know, and if you know how to concentrate, and the very process of concentration itself can lead you to the knowledge that you are looking for. So I would say spiritual education should basically concentrate itself upon learning the science of concentration. Secondly, it consists of what Mother calls tapasya. Tapasya. There are different kinds of austerities. What Mother speaks of tapasya, tapasya of knowledge. That is to say, concentration which purifies the faculties of the mind, so that the mind becomes capable of arriving at knowledge. Secondly, tapasya of love. As you know, love at present is a very mixed affair. And tapasya of love implies a great process of purification. The liberation of our entire realm of emotions from various kinds of desires to possess, to oppress, to enjoy momentary enjoyments, and so on. Purification of emotions from all these impurities, so that love begins to shine and vibrate and better burn actually in our heart. This burning of heart, so that all impurities are burnt away and the purity of love alone remains in our consciousness. Thirdly is the tapasya of will. At present, our will is full of desires, petty desires, bigger desires, ambitions of various kinds. And Mother said, "N'ambition jamais, have no ambition. Et fais ce que tu fais aussi vite que possible, aussi parfaitement que possible." Have no ambition, but do what you are doing as quickly as possible and as perfectly as possible. This is the tapasya of will. And tapasya of beauty. According to me, if one develops these four processes of tapasya, it's a preliminary development of concentration. This is spiritual education. It is the foundations of spiritual education. And then comes a higher stage, which should not be given to everybody except when the individual makes a personal decision. This concentration and the tapasya can be proposed to everybody. But the next step of spiritual education is kanishta. It cannot be given unless the individual says, I have now decided to accept the full discipline of spiritual education. That is why when you want to popularize spiritual education in the world, please limit only to these processes which I have spoken of him now. The next step can be given and must be given to those who have decided. And that process is what I call the process of self-consecration. The first stage was self-concentration. Now you come to the stage of self-consecration. And self-consecration requires a tremendous sadhana, tremendous development of obedience. But obedience of illumined disciple of the truth. So first you should become disciple of truth and should develop discipline which is illuminating. Secondly, you must develop the heroism, a kind of obedience of a hero who fights against injustice and falsehood. It's the second aspect of the self-consecration. And third aspect of self-consecration is to become a faithful servant. One who does not know what is faithfulness cannot do self-consecration. These three qualities in this spirit, if they are developed, then comes the final stage, and that is self-transformation. And that is, of course, implies psychic transformation, spiritual transformation, supramental transformation. This will be the whole program of spiritual education. Very briefly, it has nothing to do with what missionaries are doing, reading this book or that book of scripture or all that sort of thing. This is a process in which you change the very psychological fiber of the being. Thank you.
Kirill, that was so beautiful and profound. And in fact, it seems as if almost like a seed summary of the new synthesis of yoga that can break the impasse as you have brought up.